Good evening. Thank you all for coming, and thank you to the organizers. I'm very honored to be here, and it's a great pleasure, actually. I was a bit, at the beginning, a bit worried because I thought, well, I'm not up to this, but now I think that things are coming together in an extraordinary way, and I also want to thank the organizers because they gave us, all the interveners have a few key words that are in the titles of what we've been given. So I'm going to very quickly cover those titles because they are thought-provoking and interesting. The first is, of course, monsters. This is the time of monsters. I have been waiting for someone to quote Gramsci. The old is dying, the new cannot be born, and in the interim, there is a time of monsters. The less flamboyant translations say there are morbid symptoms, but there are other translations that say this is the time of monsters. And certainly we are in this period of the old is dying and the new cannot be born. So that's the first overriding theme. The second one is what comes after nation states? Well, I've got a couple of answers to that. I have pessimistic ones and I have optimistic ones. The optimistic answers are what comes after nations is maybe cities, because cities are becoming more and more important. They are closest to the citizens. They are closest to the important things in life, which are energy, water, food, shelter, all of those things. Cities are the first responsible ones. And it's interesting to see that under Donald Trump, the mayor of Chicago immediately invited mayors of Mexico to come and talk to him so that they could determine how, in the Trump era, they were going to continue to cooperate. And Chicago has declared a safety zone for Latinos because they do not want the federal government to be able to make all of the rules. They want to keep the doors open. What also comes after nation states is a form of secession from the federal government. I see people all over the world making their own structures, whether it's something as simple as a local garden, a collective garden, or whether it's much more complex in terms of local currencies or local arrangements to deal with certain basic problems, whether schools or health or but there's a lot going on at the grassroots, which has not been brought together yet. At least I don't know any single volume that tells you about exactly what's happening here and there. But there is a kind of secession. People are saying, I'm sick of waiting for the state to do something, and we can do something ourselves, which is absolutely true. But I also have a couple of pessimistic answers to what comes after nations, and those are very quickly fatal climate change. This is what keeps me awake. I don't have to quote that to you, but maybe you don't know that there are bubbles of methane gas that are beginning to explode in Siberia. And methane is 20 times as strong as CO2. Some scientists say 50. I don't know what it is. But it's either 20 or more times as strong as greenhouse gases of CO2 and others. So there we have something extremely dangerous, which now seems to be ignored. And I'll get back to that. But that is a definite danger for my grandchildren and for yours, for the future. The second pessimistic reply is that chaos could take over. There are studies that have been made by complexity theorists, mathematicians, who have looked at complexity in great detail, and I won't quote the whole of the study, but these three people from the Zurich Polytechnic, who are mathematicians, have taken a huge sample of transnational corporations, over 40,000. They've reduced this by seeing who is the most interconnected to whom, who owns part of this one or is part of the other one. And they have reduced it to some 700 companies which own 80% of the sample, and then they reduce it to 147, which own or are connected to 40% of the sample of 43,000, and then they reduce it to 50 companies in the world, which they say represent the knife edge property. And the knife edge means you can fall on that side or you can fall on this side. And the knife edge property is, for these 50 corporations, their fragility and their interconnectedness, which can be an enormous deficit for the whole world. Because this interconnection means that if there is a failure in one of those companies, and it happens that the database they were using was written in 2007, and so Lehman Brothers is on the list of the 50 most interconnected companies, and you know what happened to Lehman Brothers. But if it happens again, you should know that 48 of those 50 companies are financial. They're either banks or hedge funds or financial services companies or insurance companies. The only two that aren't are Walmart and the Chinese Petroleum Group. So if one of those crashes, the effect would be much worse than what happened with Lehman Brothers. And that's what I call the world falling into chaos. You lose your salary, you lose your pension, you lose your insurance, you lose your social pension, your social security, etc., etc. It's chaos and it's anarchy. Then we have another big title that the organizers have given us, and that is the standard of civilization. And here I'm getting into the nation state, because I don't think the nation state is necessarily setting the standards of civilization. I think in history, if you just look back, what are the big names in history? Again, they're cities. They are Athens, Rome, Florence, more recently Vienna and Berlin and Paris in the beginning of the 20th century. But I would say those are the standards of civilization that we have in the West. I'm speaking about the West. I'm not trying to include Asia or any other continent in this. So states are really quite a recent phenomenon. We didn't always have this structure. It's really a post-revolutionary phenomenon with France, with the United States, and then other nation states taking shape. But this is recent. When 9 out of 10 people in the world were peasants living in villages, the state didn't mean very much to them. Louis XIV, for instance, King Louis XIV, had 500,000 soldiers ready for war, 500,000 soldiers in what he would call France, but he only had 2,000 at the borders. France was not the kind of entity, even though I'm choosing it because it's not only my country, but it is the one that is considered the most centralized. But in the 17th, 18th century, a person, if you asked who he was and where he belonged, he would say, well, I live in this village, and I know the next three villages, and I know my region. I'm a Normand, or I'm an Occitan, or I'm a Berrichon, but he wouldn't say I'm French. That would be unheard of. Brittany was practically a different country, so was Occitanie. The phenomenon of France, of Germany, Germany was full of principalities, so was Italy. It wasn't nation states. That was not the important category. So, not much problem of governance there. And you don't need much governance in villages either. If 9 people out of 10 are farmers, they know each other. Do you know the concept of the Dunbar number? Robin Dunbar, who's a British political science anthropologist, he says the most people that most human beings can cope with, knowing something about those other human beings, is an average of 150. It could be 130, it could be 170, but that's about what we can individually cope with, knowing something about each of those people. And that was what most villages were, and people really knew each other, and they stuck together, and they were a unit. But that doesn't take governance. So we are in a recent period. That's what we're talking about here, and I really appreciate what Tony said about the history of trade, because I have done a lot of work on trade, but I've never really considered all of that. By the way, I insert the fact that if you are thinking about reading Grotius, please also, and the Spaniards, please also read the brief history of the destruction of the Indies by Father Bartolomeo de las Casas, who tells you a very, very different story from the one about the right to trade. But anyway, I'm finally arriving at the real subject of this panel. Before the right to trade, which Tony described, people didn't ask permission. They just did it. The archaeologists have found shells in places that are so far from the shore that it would be impossible. They were using them for exchange. And even in Christian times, 500 BC, archaeologists have found evidence that merchants were using 10 weights, 10 measures, 10 currencies to exchange with other people. So they knew they weren't being cheated, and they could make connections between all these different ways of measuring. So nobody was asking permission to trade. There were no passports on the Silk Road, and there were no tariffs. It was just haggling. You, one merchant, if you wanted to trade, you could become a trader, but you had to know how to haggle. Just as if you ever bought a carpet in Turkey, you know what I'm talking about. And modern trading was really established with the modern state, because then you need, if it's going to be state to state, eventually you're going to need diplomacy, you're going to need agreements. Otherwise, you get into horrid fights like beggar my neighbor, as between the two wars, the two world wars. The beggar my neighbor is when you devalue and you sell your goods cheaper so that I can beat you and you can beat me if you make the right decisions. But it's a race to the bottom, and nobody wanted to see a repeat of World War II. So after that, there was a lot more attention to agreements. And John Maynard Keynes tried to solve this problem. He proposed a system called the International Trade Organization, which involved a special trading currency, which he called the Bancor. And with this, you could have all the trading nations who would sign up to this organization, and they would be governed by a rule which said, you have a right to have so much of a surplus, you have a right to have so much of a deficit, but beyond that, which would be an average of the past 5 years for each of those, beyond that, you are going to have to pay even if you have a surplus. So this made me smile, because I thought, well, Germany has a surplus of 9% of a surplus in trade above GDP, and that means that Germany, in the Keynesian system, would have had to pay into a central fund so that we could have a more equilibrium between countries trading. Well, this was killed by the United States in 1948, and there was replaced by the GATT, the G-A-A-T, General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs. This was for goods only. That solved a certain number of problems, but not enough. And it went on to the rounds for establishing the World Trade Organization, the WTO. This was through the Uruguay round in 1986. And after that, the World Trade Organization went into effect in 1994, but they there was not very much action. It had a good dispute settlement system where you could, even if you were a small country, if you could afford it, you could bring a suit against a trader, a nation that you thought was unfair. But this has evolved a lot because after the Uruguay round, and very little happened, they started the so-called Doha development round in 2001, and that went nowhere. And states were getting impatient. They wanted more freedom. They wanted to have basic changes, and they were asking for rules which would favorize transnational corporations. Well, they finally got this. The Doha round is dead, or virtually so. They still talk about it, but it has not been officially closed, but it is really closed. World trade is now made up by 60 to 70% of trade between subsidiaries of the same transnational corporation. And the trade between transnational corporations is an equally large part. It's not in terms of nations anymore. If you really look at the detail, it's in terms of which companies are trading with which companies. Well, the presence of transnational corporations in governance is a word that I don't like, because it came back into fashion. In medieval times, it meant governance of yourself, of your family, of your estate, of your personhood, but it didn't mean anything about central governance, state governance. Now it's come back, but it came back in the 70s under the guise of corporate governance, because it's a great word. Government means something specific. We all have an idea of what a government is, but governance is something else. And in Tony's introduction, he mentioned the fact that this was a concept which was taken over later by the World Bank and the IMF, and very useful, because they were running countries' economies. They were telling them through structural adjustment what they could and what they couldn't do. And if a country was misbehaving, they might say, well, you've done pretty well on this, but your governance is still bad. It's not an effective measure, and it doesn't mean government. So now, in the more recent time, what we have had is the TTIP. I'm pretty sure everyone in this room knows what that is, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, because Germany has been the most effective country in Europe to avoid this treaty go into action. It's a treaty between Europe and the United States, the European Union and the United States. And it is extremely dangerous because it takes on particular governmental responsibilities. The ISDS, the investor-to-state dispute settlement process, has been used in hundreds of bilateral treaties. And what it does is to allow a corporation to sue a sovereign government if that government has passed a law or a decree which the corporation considers a violation of its present or even future profits. Now, this is a private tribunal. It has nothing to do with the state courts. I can understand it when Germany made an agreement with Pakistan in 1959. That was the first bilateral trade and investment treaty, because Pakistan perhaps does not have a very solid judicial system. But you can't justify it when it's between Europeans and the United States, which both have solid judicial systems. So what it is, what the TTIP is really a bill of rights for corporations to invade the judicial system. And it's not just the judicial side. There is also a process called regulatory cooperation, which is under not yet in function, because the TTIP is in the freezer for the moment, but I think it will come back. And regulatory cooperation was written, it's a kind of agreement written by Business Europe and the United States Chamber of Commerce. And what it says basically is that corporations should be present at the beginning of the process of regulating any sector, so that the legislator is defrauded and his or her capacity to make laws to regulate health, pharmaceuticals, food safety, et cetera, is denied. And when you have a possibility that you as a government are going to be sued by several companies, which are from the US or for any country with which you have an agreement, a bilateral trade and investment agreement, that government can perfectly well say to itself, well, I better not pass this or that law, because if I do, I'm going to have four or five companies on my back. And they are asking for more and more compensation. There are many suits now which are demanding over $1 billion. And to give you just one or two examples, Ecuador recently lost in a suit brought by Occidental Petroleum and has been ordered to pay Occidental $1.8 billion. Now, I don't know how big a proportion that is of the health and education budget in Ecuador, but if there were three or four suits like that, they would think twice. In Romania, Romania is being sued by another mining company that wants to use enough cyanide in the gold mining process to kill the entire population of the world. And Romania is resisting, but this company is bringing suit. There's no decision yet, but this could be extremely serious. So you have the judicial, the legislative, and the executive functions all attacked at the same time by transnationals. I will try to finish within 2-3 minutes. So I don't use more than my time, but the presence of TNCs in governance, I think, can only be a bad thing. If they are replacing the real functions of government. This is being carried out also by Davos in a big way. Davos has a new project, which is not very much talked about, which is called, modestly, the Global Redesign Initiative. And the Global Redesign Initiative is committees chosen by Davos, always including corporations, but sometimes they bring on academics, they bring in celebrities, they bring in other, what they call stakeholders. That's another word I hate, because stakes are always, in English, a stake means something financial. It means you have a bet on a horse, I've got a stake in that horse, or you can have a stake which is literally a piece of land. That was the 19th century definition, that the government gave you 40 acres to farm. And a stake is not a capacity to participate in government. A stake, you're a stakeholder only if I tell you you are. And if Davos tells you you're a stakeholder, that's okay. But ask civil society to be a stakeholder. No, that's not on. So they are having these meetings, some of which have gone further than others, but they take on 80 subjects, all of which are to do with the world governance, global redesign, and it can go from seas and fisheries to finance, to human rights, to education. It covers the world, and that is the Davos contribution. And then we have also the new, well, there's a lot of examples of the UN also being taken over. The UN has a department now which is called the Global Compact, which has 8,000 companies from dozens of countries, all of which need only sign on for 10 principles, and then they can use the UN logo, but nobody ever monitors them. Nobody ever sees if they have really respected environmental and labor principles. No, it costs very little to join, and you are allowed to use the UN logo. This was invented by Kofi Annan and Nestle in 1999. So the UN is also accepting people like Bill Gates at the World Health Organization. He gives keynote speeches. He is pushing for outside control and the of the pharmaceutical and the health industries. And this is very tempting because WHO does not have its own budget. I mean, the budget can vary, but they do not have a UN budget. So a lot of Gates' money is often very welcome, and you too would accept that he give keynote speeches. Then the other thing has happened since Trump took over the White House, because there we really have something new. Look at the cabinet. The cabinet is there to destroy the sector of which the person is the secretary. Mrs. DeVos in education is a lifelong friend of private education. She is there to destroy public education. The Secretary of Labor is there to get rid of labor regulations. The Secretary of Commerce is to bring in more transnational participation. The prisons are being privatized. Healthcare, they are destroying the Obamacare system, etc. And I quote Steve Bannon, who is Trump's principal advisor, who has said, deconstruction of the administrative state is one of his goals. Deconstruction of the administrative states. And this is very interesting, because if you want to spread capitalism, and if you want to make capitalism keep ticking over, the best thing to do is to privatize everything that has been regulated and everything that is under the governance of the state. So that's what you do. You deregulate, and then you introduce the corporations, and then they run it. And this is going to be, if Trump continues in office, this is going to be something which overtakes us and gives us a totally new configuration. So I would say the IMF and the World Bank and that old structure, even the WTO, they've all been downgraded. They're not nearly as important as they used to be. We have a very little impact as people. What we can do is understand what is going on and denounce it. And I congratulate Germany on having had so many signatures and having helped us, the organization Mehr Demokratie, I admire greatly. But I just want to tell you in closing that against the TTIP, instead of, because the commission did not accept our proposal to have a citizens' initiative, we self-organized a citizens' initiative, but using all the rules of the European Commission. And the rules are 1 million votes from at least 7 countries that have met their quota as fixed by the Commission. And at the end of a year, in a self-organized initiative, we had 3.4 million votes, and we had them from 23 countries. The only countries missing were Malta, Cyprus, and the three Baltic states. So congratulations to Germany, which really took this in hand, and I hope you were all signatories to this. And if the TTIP comes back, then we all have to be on deck, because without people, without citizen pressure, we are going to be governed entirely by corporate decisions. Thank you.